This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
Scorching heat in the U.S. South underlines the absolute dependence on air conditioning and the grid that powers all those machines. Now AC is moving much farther north to Portland and Seattle, never mind the oven that was Spain, Portugal, and even Paris in 2022. Stan Cox wrote about all this in his 2010 book, Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. We talked about it on Radio EcoShock. But there is another Stan Cox. Beyond his six books, by day Stan was for years lead breeder for the Land Institute Sorghum Program. His work partnered with seven countries, from India through Africa to America. We will find out why this food staple matters even more in a warming world. But now Stan has joined the Ecosphere Studies team at the Land Institute. He is tracking the global ecologic emergency. From Salina, Kansas, Stan Cox, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, good to be back with you, Alex.
12 years after you and I rang the bell on air conditioning, machine cooling is spreading farther around a warming world. Does it still cause you to worry about it?
Yes, it certainly does, because around 2012, a couple of years after we talked, finally you started seeing a lot of concern in the U.S. about air conditioning and the fact that both through refrigerants and through energy consumption, that it is responsible for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and ensuring that future summers will be even hotter. But around that time, the prompt for this increased concern was not what I'd been bringing up, that we, you know, way overuse air conditioning in this country. It was that a lot of other countries that have a lot of high temperature areas are now taking up air conditioning, and they have a lot of people, you know, India, China, and that's going to ruin the atmosphere, cause runaway global warming and so forth. So the kind of thing that nobody wanted to think about when it was just us doing it, then there was a lot of alarm. But of course, there, you know, nothing is being done about either.
I suppose heat pumps are a slight advance over the old air conditioning technology.
Well, they're an advance for heating. They are an advance over burning fuel oil or natural gas, or using electricity from a power plant for heating elements and that kind of thing. But a heat pump is just a reverse air conditioner, and so there's the indirect savings of emissions from heating, but it will still be using the same amount of energy and causing emissions for running it as air conditioning.
All right, well, let's switch over here. Now, you spent over a decade working on a crop that is just not well known by listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. I wasn't really familiar with it. What is sorghum and why does it matter?
Sorghum is I think it's still in volume produced and used is the fifth most important food grain on Earth. It originated about 8,000 years ago in the area of East Africa that is today South Sudan, somewhere around there. And it's a plant that looks, right before it produces seed, it looks very similar to a corn plant. It's in the same part of the grass family, but it produces its grain at the top of the plant where corn has a tassel, so it doesn't have an ear, but it has a head full of grain at the top. It spread around from Africa into Asia through tropical areas throughout ancient times, and it was only in the mid-20th century that American farmers started growing grain sorghum. There was also forage sorghum, which the stalks and leaves are fed to cattle. But unlike the sorghum in Africa or South Asia, which is almost 100% eaten as human food, kind of like it makes a product kind of like cornmeal, in the United States, almost all of it goes either toward feeding livestock or in producing fuel ethanol for to run cars and trucks. And it's primarily, I'm here in Kansas, in the center of the country, and the bulk of the grain sorghum in the U.S. is grown in a kind of a strip up the middle of the country from Texas through Oklahoma, Kansas, and a little bit into Nebraska.
So there are different types of sorghum, some grown like a cereal for humans, as you say, and some grown in fields as fodder for animals. I was surprised to learn that excess heat and drought, and we've seen lots of that, can turn sorghum fodder somewhat toxic. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, and that's generally in the younger part of the sorghum's life. So it sprouts in the spring and comes up and may look like a field of corn seedlings coming up. And that young, fast-growing vegetation, if there is a drought or, conversely, a freeze or some kind of stress, it can cause the plant to produce something called prussic acid, which is a compound that, you know, if the cattle eat it, that prussic acid will produce hydrogen cyanide, the notorious poison, and kill them. And so breeders in the United States have worked on developing sorghums that don't respond to stress that way and don't produce prussic acid. But in general, they generally avoid having cattle graze on sorghum just to be sure. They will then, later cut it for silage, or after the crop is harvested, cattle can go out and eat the dry stalks. But the sorghum that I've been working on here at Land Institute for a couple of decades is something that is not in commercial production yet. It's still in the experimental stage, a perennial sorghum, which instead of being planted every spring, being harvested in the fall, and the plants dying off, then you have to do tillage or herbicides or something and then disturb the soil again in the spring and sow again. Instead of that, perennial sorghum will survive through the winter as underground stems, so you don't see any life there at all. But then if those stems survive and put up shoots in the spring, so you get a second crop, third crop, et cetera, each season without having to replant.
And how's that going? Do we have that?
Well, as I said, we're still in the breeding stage, but we've made a lot of advances so that now we're getting close to having varieties, not varieties, but breeding lines that are perennial and do produce decent grain, but we're at this point, they are going to be mainly targeted toward the tropics and subtropics, and most particularly toward parts of African continent, because the underground stems they produce are not quite winter hardy enough to survive a Kansas winter. That's one of the reasons we're targeting tropics. And the other reason is that we're aiming it to be specifically a food grain, because we wouldn't go to all this work just to have it used in factory farming of animals or fueling SUVs. So we're working with colleagues in Uganda and other countries who will be taking what the perennial sorghum we've developed, making crosses, hybridization with their locally adapted annual sorghum and selecting perennial sorghum there.
Well, taking a realistic view, some experts on climate change suggest humans will have to adapt what we eat. We may have to switch our diets to more heat-resistant crops, and sorghum is often mentioned. Could sorghum help feed a warming planet?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, already in places like the high plains here in western Kansas, down through the Texas panhandle, sorghum, because of its heat and drought tolerance, has displaced a lot of corn that be grown there otherwise. And that's the reason in these semi-arid parts of the African continent also are traditionally sorghum growing, and they have places where maybe people prefer corn, but it's too unreliable because of heat and drought, and sorghum is much more reliable grain producer.
Well, yes, let's talk about Kansas for a minute. The state government says agriculture is the largest economic driver in the state. It's worth at least $76 billion annually, and that's bigger than the gross domestic product of about 130 countries by my count. So, Stan, I heard that the so-called dry line is advancing towards Kansas, and what is the predicted climate future for this critical food-producing state?
Yeah, you're right. The dry line is a line running north-south, west of which the amount of rainfall and precipitation that an area gets on average is less than the amount of moisture that is pulled out of the ground by plants or evaporates from the surface of the soil. So there's a built-in deficit of moisture for growing plants or for doing a lot of things that agriculture is dependent on pumping groundwater out of the ground or from reservoirs and so forth. And that line is right around the 100th meridian, which is a couple of hours west of where I'm sitting here in western Kansas. And I've seen some predictions that by the end of this century, the dry line might have moved almost to Kansas City, more than a couple of hundred miles to the east. And certainly where I am in Salina would be in that place where there is not enough water to grow crops without irrigation, and we probably wouldn't have much water available for irrigation by that time anyway.
Are experts at the Land Institute seeing the impacts of global warming already, and what do you hear from farmers?
Yes, I'll give one example, which has been a big pain for us. We grew for the first, 15 plus years of the sorghum program here. We were pretty much pest free, and insect mites, et cetera, were not a problem. It would just be very sporadic. Then starting in about 2015, we suddenly had an outbreak of the yellow sugarcane aphid, this little sucking insect that was a tropical pest. And in the Caribbean, in sugarcane growing areas, it would attack sugarcane. It would sometimes get into the very lower South Texas area where they grow sorghum. But with the winters getting warmer and warmer, suddenly every year since, the sugarcane aphid has made it up as far as Kansas, and it can really decimate a crop. And there's another insect that a couple of years later, it's even worse, that we suddenly started having problems with, that had been strictly a tropical, subtropical insect, which is the sorghum midge, this teeny tiny fly that lays its eggs where each seed is supposed to be developing, and so the plant basically produces no seed. And that's another one that we wouldn't be having if we had the kind of winters that we had in past decades.
I work with plants almost every day, out in the garden or in the greenhouse, and they inspire and amaze me, even the weeds, maybe especially the weeds. Stan, do you sometimes translate your plant knowledge into understanding the human crisis?
One thing that we say around here is because we really believe that perennial crops are going to be necessary, we kind of jokingly say that our ancestors 10,000 years ago made a big mistake domesticating only annual crops, because at the time they were harvesting seed, hunter-gatherers, they were picking seed from both perennial and annual species, but for various technical reasons they domesticated only the annual species, so that now over billions of acres around the world that had always been under natural ecosystems in which almost 100% of the plants are typically perennial. They replaced those, and we continue to replace them with much more fragile annual monoculture ecosystems. And we're probably not going to solve the problems of agriculture until we get back to perennial systems.
Well, you are kind of a two-track guy. You work in detail on plants, but you also write big-picture books, at least six of them by my count. And I wonder, like, humans have this turbulent history. We can look back on our wars and our diseases and depressions. But are we in a different kind of crisis now, do you think? What makes this challenge different?
Yes, we're in the most serious crisis that humanity has faced, because now it's universal. It's not one region or another. And the world is going to be very different within just a couple of decades, not only because of climate change, but also because of we have overshot, transgressed several of these so-called planetary boundaries. We have this mass extinction event going on. We're losing daily a lot of the biodiversity of the planet, the world's nitrogen and phosphorus cycles, and the water cycles are completely haywire because of industry. And both the world that we see around us today and these problems exist because of the fossil fuel bonanza of the past 100 years. And if we had not had those ancient fuels dug or pumped from the ground, we would not see anything like today's world would be more like the world of the 1700s. There would be a lot fewer humans and a lot less stuff. But because of that, having that energy available and not restraining ourselves, today, believe it or not, the total human-made mass, that is everything that humanity has manufactured or built and is still in existence, outweighs the total standing biomass of the Earth. It seems incomprehensible to me, but everything living on the Earth, weigh all of that up, it's dry matter, and it's less than what we've built and manufactured. And that trend is accelerated, and it's reaching a limit. It can't go on much longer.
In 2020, you published a book about ending the climate emergency while we still can. Noam Chomsky wrote the foreword. Do you think our current institutions can react quickly enough to save humanity from ourselves?
Well, things are happening fast, because I wrote that book during 2019, and around 2018 and the run-up to those midterm elections just 4 years ago, there was a lot of excitement. That's when people were talking about the Green New Deal. There seemed to be a lot of momentum behind it. Bernie Sanders' people got a World War II-style mobilization for climate into the Democratic Party platform, et cetera. And so I wrote the book in 2019, kind of saying, okay, how's it going with this, and what will a Green New Deal do for us? And probably more importantly, what is it still lacking that we're going to have? Where are the holes in it? And the main hole was and still is, there's no direct surefire mechanism for phasing out fossil fuels completely, to take the quantities of oil, gas, and coal that are being extracted and burned, take it down in very rapid fire fashion year after year. But and other people were pushing ways to do this. We are demonstrating just verbally how it could be done, and it would be a big political lift, but it seemed non-feasible. Then after the disappointments of the past couple of years on failure to get any really significant climate legislation passed by Congress, and now looking at the possibility that we'll end up with, by a couple of years from now, far-right control of all three branches of government, it's looking dimmer all the time that the United States is going to manage to reduce its fossil fuel use or greenhouse gas emissions quickly enough to avoid some really catastrophic warming. And obviously, if we're not doing it, then the world as a whole is not going to do it either. There's a lot of talk and excitement about things like a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty by which the whole all the countries of the world would work together on reducing their fossil fuel use and emissions and so forth. But the prospects are not looking good. If the United States completely fails on this, then it's not going to be good.
Well, in another book, one of the solutions you considered in detail was rationing, and that may come yet for energy-challenged countries in Europe this winter. But I still see advertising pushing everyone to consume as much as possible, no limits, even though nature has limits. Could rationing actually be socially redeeming if we get that far?
And rationing is involved in the kind of policies that my colleagues and I have been pushing for, but rationing, rather than being the means of reducing consumption, rationing, its role is as an adaptation to short supply and high prices. That, like you, as you were saying, could be seeing rationing of heating fuel in Europe this winter. That would be because there's externally imposition of a shortage of fuel. Then the only way to have fairness and sufficiency, so everybody gets enough, but that it isn't used to excess, is with rationing. And that's what we've been pushing for, but in this case, self-imposed restraint, where we have a law that puts a cap on the amounts of oil, gas, and coal that can be extracted and burned, and then ratchets that cap down year by year. And that would, because that would have to happen faster than we can build up renewable energy capacity, it would mean the national energy supply would be going down by some amount, and that would almost certainly trigger a need for price controls and rationing, just as it did during World War II.
Your latest book is The Path to a Livable Future, A New Politics to Fight Climate Change, Racism, and the Next Pandemic. We are starting to run out of time, but could you briefly explain, are those three really connected, and should they be?
Yes, I wrote that one. The Green New Deal and Beyond came out in the spring of 2020, just as the first wave of COVID was hitting. And then a couple of months later, we had killing of George Floyd and the racial reckoning that we had during that summer. And my editor at City Lights Books said, I think you're going to need a sequel to the Green New Deal book. And so I, looking at it, the roots of all three of these problems, climate, systemic racism, and pandemics, are the roots are intertangled, both because of they all, to one extent or another, are either triggered by the abuse of ecosystems, or they have unequal, disparate consequences for different parts of the human species, different people, who different groups of people, and especially the marginalized communities, indigenous peoples, et cetera, the people least responsible for causing the problem, the ecological problems have to pay the higher price, and not only with climate, but also certainly with the impacts of the pandemic on, take for example, migrant farm workers who or the people working in meatpacking plants who were, you know, categorized as essential workers, so it doesn't matter. You've got to work under those same conditions that foster the spread of the virus. And in the case of the farm workers, they weren't given masks except on days when federal inspectors were going to be coming. Anyway, in the book, I describe how all of those, the collision of all those problems came in 2020, and discuss what, is there a way to avoid this in the future?
Well, yes, I think we have some people who think we'll just work on climate change and fix that, and then we'll get around to racism and public health, and no. It's one big complex, and they're all tied together, and we make it or we don't. From Salina, Kansas, and the Land Institute, we have been speaking with research fellow and author Stan Cox. You can find links to Stan and his works in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, and please check out landinstitute.org. Stan, it was great to talk with you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. One of the world's leading climate scientists, Johan Rockström, has a dim view. According to The Guardian's environment reporter Damien Carrington, published October 27th, Rockström said, quote, "It's a really bleak moment, not only because of the reports showing that emissions are still rising, so we are not delivering on either the Paris or Glasgow climate agreements, but we also have so much scientific evidence that we are very, very close to irreversible changes. We are coming closer to tipping points," end quote from Johan Rockström. Please stay tuned to Radio EcoShock Weekly as we broadcast science-based truth about the greatest threat ever faced by humanity. No exaggeration, that's what it is, and it's a threat to our cohabitants, all the loving species here on planet Earth. Please stay tuned to Radio EcoShock Weekly as we broadcast science-based truth. Thank you for seeking out the hard truth, wherever it leads, and still caring about our world.